You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
Here for the Lowe's early Black Friday deals? You're right on time for some of our biggest savings. We're talking up to 50% off select major appliances, plus up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. Holiday lights going up soon? Select ladders are up to 50% off right now. Get Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 11/19. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details. Lowe's knows that saving is always top of mind, especially this season. That's why we've picked some great deals for early Black Friday. Get free select DeWalt, Kobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit. More tools? Why not? Plus, we've got select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees starting at $59.98, because it's never too early to think Christmas. Get Black Friday prices without the crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. While supplies last, selection varies by location. Here for the Lowe's early Black Friday deals? You're right on time for some of our biggest savings. We're talking up to 50% off select major appliances, plus up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. Holiday lights going up soon? Select ladders are up to 50% off right now. Get Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 11/19. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
There are some stories that never really end. They just kind of keep evolving, challenging everything we think we know about justice, medicine, and accountability. The story of Maya Kowalski is one of them. Maybe you've seen the Netflix docuseries, Take Care of Maya. We're going to talk about the case, not necessarily exactly from the perspective of the documentary, but more from reality and facts, and give you the latest update on what went on here, because a judge just threw out the judgment, the civil judgment, in this case. Was that the right move? Was that the wrong move? I'm not here to tell you if it is or isn't. I'm going to let you make that decision on your own. But I want to go through the details of this case and break down the breakdowns in our system that basically allowed this whole debacle to take place the way that it did. Because this is a complicated case. There's not just one clear villain here. I don't know if anyone in this case was ever truly trying to be a villain here, but that's how their actions ended up playing out. Again, let you decide. Let's just listen. Let's just kind of go through the facts. And let me know in the comments section what your thoughts are. No right, no wrong. Just everyone's certainly entitled to their opinion on this case, and everybody's got one. And that's good. So if you're on YouTube, let me know your thoughts. And if you're not on YouTube, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi is what you search, and you find us, you press subscribe, and then you chat it up. So what began nearly a decade ago as a desperate search for relief from unimaginable pain has become one of the most polarizing courtroom sagas in recent memory. And now, after a Florida jury handed down one of the largest civil verdicts in state history, more than $213 million, an appellate court has erased it completely. This is the case that inspired that Netflix doc, the Take Care of Maya. It captivated the country, not because anyone questioned whether Maya was suffering, but because it forced us to ask, when does protection become imprisonment, and when does accountability become overreach? Now, as the judgment is overturned and the story circles back into the courts, we're left with more questions than actual answers. Maya Kowalski's story starts in pain, literal, physical, chronic pain. She was diagnosed with complex regional pain syndrome, otherwise known as CRPS. It's a rare and excruciating neurological condition that affects the way the body processes pain signals. Those who live with it often describe sensations so intense that even a light touch can feel like fire. Can you imagine living like that? Being a child. Life is already confusing enough as a child. When this is your norm, my God. Her mother, Beta Kowalski, or Beata Kowalski, she was a nurse. She was experienced, assertive, and determined to help her daughter by any means necessary. Under medical supervision, Maya began receiving high-dose ketamine infusions, an experimental but sometimes effective treatment for severe CRPS. Those treatments had been administered in Mexico and later by Florida physicians. In October 2016, Maya's condition flared up so badly that her parents brought her to Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital in St. Petersburg, Florida. And it was supposed to be a stop for stabilization, maybe a place for safety. Instead, it became a site of nightmare. Within days, hospital staff raised red flags. They believed Maya's symptoms and her mother's insistence on continuing high-dose ketamine resembled something else. Signs of Munchausen syndrome by proxy, a rare but devastating form of child abuse where a caregiver fabricates or induces illness in their child for attention or control. In Florida, medical professionals are mandatory reporters, and that means if they suspect child abuse, they must report it. Not may, must. And they did. Once that report reached the Department of Children and Families, or DCF, the hospital's relationship with the family changed entirely. Maya was placed under a shelter order, meaning she could not leave the hospital, and her mother's access was restricted. Phone calls were cut off and visits stopped. Days turned into weeks and weeks into months. Beata, already emotionally exhausted from her daughter's pain, now found herself locked out, treated as an abuser rather than a mother. She fought relentlessly through lawyers, court motions, and pleas for contact, but each request came back the same: no visitation. Then in January 2017, after nearly 3 months of being unable to see or speak to her daughter, Beata took her own life. Her suicide note included words that would echo through the courtroom years later: "I cannot bear this pain anymore." Maya was released to her father soon after, and fast forward then 6 years, and the Kowalski family filed a sweeping civil lawsuit against Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital, accusing them of false imprisonment, battery, fraudulent billing, medical negligence, and the intentional infliction of emotional distress, as well as wrongful death for Beata's suicide. The family's argument was simple but powerful, that the hospital went beyond its duty to report and it took on the role of jailer, denying a family their rights and a child, her mother. The hospital's defense was equally clear. They were following the law. They had a legal and moral duty to protect a child they believed might be in danger. And once DCF took over, the hospital was acting under state authority. In late 2023, the trial unfolded in Sarasota County courtrooms. It was emotional, it was combative, and it was raw. The jury heard weeks of testimony from medical professionals, social workers, the Kowalski family, and even Maya herself, now a teenager, recounting those traumatic months up on the stand, having to basically be re-traumatized again. They listened to recordings of calls, read through hospital logs, and relived the days leading up to Beata's death. And in November of 2023, they delivered the verdict. The hospital was liable. The total award, more than $250 million, later reduced by the court to $213.5 million. It was a stunning rebuke of a major medical institution. It wasn't just about compensation. It was a moral statement. But in the legal world, a verdict is never the end. It's the beginning of another battle. the one that happens on paper, inside appellate briefs and in a sterile chamber of judicial review. 2 years later, that battle reached the Second District Court of Appeal, and this time the tone was a little different. In its October 29th, 2025 ruling, the appellate court reversed the entire judgment. Their opinion was blunt. The trial court made significant legal errors. According to the panel, the hospital was protected under Florida Statute Chapter 39, the state's child abuse reporting law, specifically Section 39.2031A, which grants immunity to any person who reports suspected child abuse in good faith or who participates in child protection proceedings under state authority. The court ruled that once the hospital made the initial report to DCF, it effectively became an agent of the state for the purpose of holding Maya until DCF took further action. That meant many of the claims, false imprisonment, intentional infliction of emotional distress, wrongful death, and others couldn't legally stand. The judges said the trial judge should have dismissed those claims before they even reached a jury. The only exception, they said, was battery, medical negligence, and intentional infliction of emotional distress, specifically related to Maya, not her mother or father. So while the jury's emotional verdict did make headlines, the appellate court's legal reasoning quietly dismantled it. For the hospital, it was vindication. In a statement released shortly after the decision, their attorney, Ethan Shapiro, said the ruling sends a clear and vital message to mandatory reporters in Florida and across the country that their duty to report suspicions of child abuse and their good faith participation in protecting children remain protected. And for a moment, let's think about that. That is important. Because take emotion out of this here for a second. When you have mandatory reporters who may look at this case, go, well, they were doing what they thought they were trying to do. No one at Johns Hopkins was like, let's take this girl away and make her suffer from her family. Like, they literally, they thought they were doing the right thing. Could it have been done better? Probably. Could it have been done in a more humane way? I would argue yes. But did they think this child was being abused at home by her mother and could potentially die because of mom's choices? Albeit, I believe mom thought she was doing the right thing as well. That's a problem with this case. You have two sides, both hell-bent on believing they are protecting the same person, both by completely opposing and different means. This isn't necessarily a case where we have a predator that has some sort of ulterior motive in mind. And when you start challenging mandatory reporting, when you start legally going after mandatory reporters, you know what starts to happen? People don't start mandatorily reporting. They start seeing it as more optional, more of a liability than a requirement. And anyone who works in a school district knows this all too well. There's a lot of districts, probably yours too, because it's probably in every single one in our country, where mandatory reporting by specific folks ends up feeling more optional. Because when you mandatorily report something and either nothing happens or something overreactive happens or just nothing of any sort of satisfaction to protect the child actually takes place, you start to go, why am I reporting this? Why am I putting myself in danger if making this call is actually going to make things worse? It's a very human, a very normal, and a logical reaction when the system does not work the way it's supposed to. When we all have seen it so many times, see something, say something, and then, well, the do something part seems to be the problem that most of our systems run against a brick wall with. Seen it myself. I've had conversations with people in school districts where information has been reported. And that, well, we're just going to let mom and dad know about this. Well, aren't you a mandatory reporter? Yes, but no, but
What's the but here? Let's talk about the but. Well, you know, sometimes we do, but sometimes it doesn't go anywhere.
Actual conversation. And look, they're basing their decisions on experience when you get that sort of response. But I've seen it in action where mandatory becomes optional. Where mandatory is just simply another hoop to jump through that maybe or maybe not makes the most sense. It shouldn't be that way. There's a reason for the mandatory in mandatory reporting. Okay, back to this story. To hospitals, this wasn't just about one case. It was about precedent. The idea that if a doctor, nurse, or institution fears being sued for reporting abuse, they might hesitate. And hesitation could mean leaving a child in danger or worse. But to others, the decision felt like the law had swallowed empathy whole, that it erased the pain of a family that lost a mother and nearly lost a child to a system that never looked back. And that's the crossroads where this case lives, between moral outrage and statutory immunity. To understand the appellate court's reasoning, you have to understand the law it leaned on. In Florida's Chapter 39, it governs child welfare. It's child welfare. It's built on one central idea. Protecting children from harm is a shared societal duty. Section 39.203 says that anyone from a teacher to a doctor to a hospital who reports suspected abuse in good faith cannot be held civilly or criminally liable for making that report or for their involvement in resulting child protection actions. The policy goal is clear, and it does protect far more than it harms. Don't punish people for trying to protect kids. Because like anything, it can be weaponized. But like many well-intentioned laws, its simplicity hides complexity. Because what happens when that good faith crosses into negligence? What if a family believes the suspicion was unfounded and the report led to irreversible damage? The law doesn't have an easy answer for that part. It assumes good faith unless proven otherwise. And that's the crux of the Kowalski case. The appellate judges found no clear evidence that the hospital acted in bad faith. They didn't say the outcome was fair or humane, just that it was legally protected. The ruling even acknowledged that Vieta's emotional distress may have contributed to her suicide, but said that under Florida law, the hospital was still immune from liability for that harm. Now, Vieta, look. Yes, was she trying to protect her daughter? Without a doubt. I do not believe Vieta had any sort of ill feelings towards her daughter, or was trying to harm her or hurt her in any sort of way that she was mentally aware of. But if we're going to be completely honest here and play with reality on reality's terms, Vieta wasn't a well human being. Vieta was not seeing reality on reality's terms. Vieta was reacting. And reacting sometimes can cause harm, even as well-intentioned as it may be. What she was doing with her daughter, those treatments, there's a reason she had to go to Mexico, because no hospital in the United States would touch it. Because doctors in America, who I think very easily arguably are some of the best in the world, said this is not a safe treatment for your daughter. This can go horribly, horribly wrong. And we're not doing this. But when mom thinks she knows better than the medical system and the medical community as a whole, she's going to do what she's going to do. And I get it. You're a parent. You're going to do anything you believe is best for your child. And if that means saying screw you to the medical community, sometimes you will do it. I'm not saying it's right, and I'm not saying it's wrong, but I'm saying it's a choice. And how is that choice being made, and where is that person mentally making that choice? And I don't think it's a crazy thing to say that Vieta was not in a great place mentally. not in a place of thinking and understanding things clearly. And I'm going to say not of her own fault either. There was something going on there. She needed her own help in her own way. It's hard to help someone else when you are not well. And it's even more difficult if you don't even realize it. And when you're in a situation that's going to continue to tear away at your already fragile mental health. Again, it's a heartbreaking case. Everybody in this did have, in my opinion, the best of intentions. Neither ended up going down a path that achieved that goal of protecting Maya, of taking care of Maya in a safe and ethical way. In plain terms, it may have been tragic, but it wasn't unlawful in terms of the hospital's choices. The decision doesn't erase the past. It just redraws the lines of responsibility. And that's what it comes down to, responsibility. The Kowalski family can still pursue claims of medical negligence and battery, meaning if the hospital staff physically overstepped or provided care outside of consent or protocol, that can still be tried in court. But the sweeping emotional and wrongful death claims that powered the original verdict, they are gone. The jury's moral verdict has been replaced by a legal one. And that's often how justice looks at these kinds of cases. Not like the dramatic endings we see on screen, but like the slow turning of gears inside a system that values process as much as it does outcome. Take Care of Maya is one side of the story. So if you're just going off of the doc and being morally outraged, I get it. I was too when I watched the doc alone. And then I started educating myself. Then I thought, well, you know what? I have agency. I don't just have to take Netflix words for it. And the documentarian who wanted to create moral outrage and a lot of excitement about their piece. Sure, it does tell a very compelling story. There is another side to that story. And as most things in reality, truth lies in the middle. It's a gray area. For those who follow the Netflix documentary, the twist raises many uncomfortable questions. The film Take Care of Maya presented a deeply sympathetic portrait of the Kowalski family. And understandably so, it was a story of loss, grief, and the perceived cruelty of a system that wouldn't listen. But the appellate ruling forces us to look at that same story through a colder lens. It does. Was a hospital's intervention a catastrophic overreach or a necessity, if tragic, step under the law? Could the same system that drove a family apart have also prevented a potential case of medical abuse if the suspicion had been valid? And perhaps the most unsettling, can both things be true? That a mother loved her daughter desperately, that a hospital acted to protect a child in good faith, and that both decisions, however well intentioned, led to ruin. From a broader perspective, this case highlights something we rarely talk about until tragedy strikes, the power of mandatory reporting laws. They exist in every state, but few of us understand their reach. When a doctor reports suspected abuse, that report can trigger an entire chain of state action. Families can lose custody, children can be institutionalized, and emotional bonds can be severed, all before a single allegation is proven true or false. That is a systematic problem. A problem where a system is well-intentioned, but once that system gets greased and gets going and you don't know how well greased it is, you don't know, is this going to be the rusty version of it today where we make the call and nothing happens? Or is this going to be the one that way the hell oversteps? Or is this going to be the one that does things in a calculated, carefully mapped out way? And anyone who's ever dealt with the system before knows it's usually the first option or the extreme option. Rarely does it seem to come in the middle where it should. And when you know that, and when you have those things happen, it certainly makes you a little more hesitant to get a system involved that you're not sure if it's going to work correctly. It's almost like, okay, look at this Ferris wheel. Doesn't this look fun? This looks great.
I remember the Ferris wheel from all the fairs in my childhood and amusement parks. It looks, look at all the people. They look like they're having a great time. And then you look at who set it up.
I go, shit. Do I trust this person to tighten those bolts and to make sure that this thing is not going to fall apart when I'm 100 feet up in the air?
Oh, it's probably not going to kill you. I mean, the odds are not there that it's going to go bad, but you know, that one doesn't look super tight up there. It looks a little, you don't want to put yourself into a dangerous potential situation when there's an if. When I get on that Ferris wheel going there, the odds of something happening are so minute, so slim that it wouldn't be a human problem. It wouldn't be a human error. If something breaks, it's because the bolts are just bad and they finally failed and no one knew that it just happened. That's kind of what the argument is here about mandatory reporting. It's an argument for the system working, but the problem is the system doesn't always work very well. And that's a problem. That's a problem because we can get this verdict in court. Great, whatever. But at the end of the day, if it does nothing to fix the system, just protect someone from having to pay out, the system ain't necessarily going, well, great, I'm glad this doesn't have to be paid out. Let's fix the system and make it even better. No, it's no part of this process, unfortunately, where the actual problem lies. Most of the time, these laws save lives. Sometimes they destroy them. And that is reality. What this case shows, perhaps more clearly than any before it, is that line between protection and punishment isn't as clean as we want it to be. As for Maya herself, she's now a young adult, no longer frightened. As a small child that we saw in those court photos or the documentaries, her voice is in all of this has been remarkably poised. She has said that what happens to her family can't be undone, and she's right. But that she wants to see the system change to make sure no other child goes through what she did. Whether this appellate ruling silences that effort or fuels it remains to be seen. I hope it fuels it. Because she's a great advocate for fixing this system. She can speak to all of its horrors. And the Kowalskis can still appeal to the Florida Supreme Court. Though such cases are rarely taken unless there's a constitutional or broad legal issue at stake. If they don't, the case will go back to trial, but on a much narrower scope. Fewer claims, less drama, smaller numbers. But maybe for Maya, the fight was never about money. Maybe it was about recognition. And in some ways, even with this reversal, she's already won that. What's left behind is a legal paradox, a hospital that acted within its statutory duty, but perhaps outside its moral one, and a family that was wronged by tragedy, but not necessarily by law, and a legal system that can't always reconcile the two. The court didn't say the hospital was right. It said the hospital was protected. And protection, as we've learned in this case, can mean very different things depending on which side of the door you're standing on. For doctors, it's protection from liability. For children, it's protection from harm. For families, sometimes it's protection that comes too late. In the end, the reversal of the Kowalski verdict isn't about who we believe. It's about what the law allows. It's a story about faith in institutions and the limits of empathy in a world run by statutes and protocols. And it leaves us with a haunting question that no amount of litigation can resolve. When everyone follows the rules, why does it still feel like something went so terribly wrong? Give me your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube. Search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi if you're not already there. And before you even leave that comment, hit subscribe. Hit subscribe if you're listening to us right now on any sort of podcast platform, wherever it is. Hit subscribe. Search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi on social media, and you'll find us there as well, all over. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Lowe's knows that saving is always top of mind, especially this season. That's why we've picked some great deals for early Black Friday. Get free select DeWalt, Kobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit. More tools? Why not? Plus, we've got select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees starting at $59.98 because it's never too early to think Christmas. Get Black Friday prices without the crowds. Lowe's, we help. You save. While supplies last, selection varies by location.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made to last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.